Testing. My name is Jesse Soriano. I am an undergraduate student at San Diego State University, and I created the following tape for Dr. Richard Griswold of Castillo's Chicano History class in cooperation with Dr. Steve Colson of the San Diego Research Center on April 25, 1978. The person interviewed is Mr. Felix Marquez of San Diego, California. The subject of our discussion was Mr. Marquez's past history in San Diego. ¿Me puede decir su nombre, fecha de nacimiento y dónde nació?
Félix Márquez, en marzo 9, 1900, Ensenada.
¿Me puede hablar de su experiencia en México antes de venir para los Estados Unidos?
Pues no, yo no he trabajado en campo. ¿Cómo se dice? En el campo nomás con mi papá, ayudando ganado, carnicería, ayudante carnicero.
¿Y la experiencia de sus padres y de su familia?
Mucha experiencia, era como ganadero, de ganado, sí. Tenía ganado nomás, rancho. Mi mamá no me da casa. No trabajaba, mi papá nomás puro ganadero, ganado, carnicería tenía, Ensenada.
¿Y qué era la razón que emigraron para los Estados Unidos?
Bueno, pues cambiar de venir aquí, pues mi familia vino primero y yo me vine solo. Una de mi familia vino a mi abuelita y primero yo me, luego me dijeron que viniera y yo me vine.
¿Qué era la fecha cuando vinieron ustedes para acá?
Cuando yo vine fue el 20 de enero de 1920.
¿Qué modo de transportación usaron para venir para acá?
En el station, en el bus, ¿cómo se dice?
¿En bus?
En el, de esos de caballo, de carrito de caballo.
¿Stagecoach?
Sí.
¿Y cuando llegaron aquí a los Estados Unidos, por qué garita cruzaron?
San Isidro. Yo.
¿Y por qué se vinieron a vivir a San Diego? ¿Tenían trabajo aquí o qué era la razón?
No, pues vine y de repente me ofrecieron trabajo y comencé a hacer algo de trabajo, de lo que había, de lo que fuera. Yo trabajé en hoteles, los platos, trabajé en hoteles y después poco a poco trabajé en canerías.
¿Qué era la fecha cuando primero llegaron aquí a San Diego y después de cruzar la garita?
Pues ese fue, ese.
¿Era la misma después de cruzar? Después de
20.
¿Cuántos años ha vivido usted aquí en San Diego? Desde
1920.
¿Y en qué parte de la ciudad vivían ustedes después que llegaron aquí?
¿Qué parte de la ciudad? De Ensenada.
No. ¿En qué parte de la ciudad aquí en San Diego, donde vivían ustedes? ¿Aquí en Logan Heights, en esos tiempos?
No, vivimos mucho tiempo en la... Vivíamos en la calle 20, viví en la, fuera de aquí. Pero tengo mucho tiempo viviendo aquí en esta área. En esta área tengo muchos años, porque viví aquí en La Cruz.
¿Dónde trabajaba usted y su familia?
Pues yo trabajaba trabajé en el Gran Hotel primero, en diferentes lugares, Pico y Pala, Cemento, últimamente en las canerías, aquí en la canería, aquí en La Cruz, en la Benque.
¿Y sus padres trabajaban también ellos?
Pues ya tenía, yo tenía mi madre aquí, pero ella no trabajaba, estaba en la casa. No vive ya, ni mi padre vive. Mi padre estaba en México, no, nunca vino aquí.
¿Qué me puede decir usted de su familia o de sus hijos, en, por ejemplo, de la educación? ¿Dónde fueron a la escuela? ¿Hasta qué grado llegaron?
Son tantos que muchos fueron a la high school, muchos fueron, terminaron la escuela, muchos no. Son 8 mujeres, 2 hombres.
¿Hermanos o hijos?
Hijos.
¿De su familia?
Hijos míos.
¿Y usted no, fue a la escuela?
Aquí, un mes. Todavía vengo aquí a la escuela.
¿No tuvo hijos usted o miembros de su familia que siguieron la escuela más alta de la high school?
No.
¿Cómo eran las condiciones raciales que se encontraban aquí en esos tiempos? ¿Cómo se trataban los mexicanos y los americanos?
En ese tiempo estoy muy bien. No es como antes, ahora tampoco, más peor. Pero antes todo el tiempo muy bien. Americanos, mexicanos, no, muy no, bien.
¿No sentía usted que había fracciones?
No, nunca, en ese tiempo no.
¿De qué tiempo estamos hablando ahorita?
1920.
¿En los 20? En ese tiempo estaba todo muy bien.
En 1920, sí.
¿Qué recuerda usted de la depresión?
Bueno, y como ya dije, nomás yo recuerdo que aquí lo estaban reportando a los los que querían, gustaban de irse. Se podían ir a sus lugares donde querían irse. No, nosotros nunca hicimos por irnos, nosotros nos quedamos aquí, nunca nos hicieron por que nos fuéramos. Nomás tienen que trabajar muy duro para poder comer aquí, en ese tiempo. Juntando un quesito por ahí, algo, comer los frijoles.
¿No había muchos trabajos en ese tiempo aquí?
No, muy, muy malo, nada de casi trabajo, muy poco había.
¿Y durante la prohibición, cuando no era legal hacer licor?
Pues, poco triste porque hacía falta.
¿Y dónde, siempre la gente que tomaba, dónde era donde conseguía el licor?
Pues, haciéndolo en sus casas. Cerveza en el bar de ahí, como, lo que podían hacer ahí en la casa, lo hacían, la cerveza o algo, licor que querían hacer, ponían sus, como dicen, alambiques, o sea, cuando había licor, pues tenían que hacer.
¿Puede discutir?
¿Mande?
Discute si quiere.
Malta.
¿Y qué recuerda usted de la Segunda Guerra Mundial?
¿De la Segunda?
Sí.
La Segunda Guerra Mundial estaba un poco mejor que la Primera.
¿Condiciones?
Sí, condiciones. Estaba poco mejor, un poquito más trabajo.
¿No hubo miembros de su familia que sirvieron en la Armada?
Sí, un hijo nomás tuvo un tiempo, pero no fue a pelear a la guerra, no fue, estuvo en el Army. No.
¿Había?
Además no, porque uno estaba malo de una pierna, no pasó.
¿Había muchos trabajos en ese tiempo?
Porque todavía poco mejor que primero. Había un poquito... Y que lavar platos por ahí, conseguía un poquito más la comida por ahí.
¿Usted recuerda durante los 30 la campaña de este gobierno para deportar a los mexicanos para atrás, para México? De un principio la campaña esta era para deportar solamente los mexicanos que estaban aquí ilegalmente o los que no tenían trabajo. ¿Usted no se acuerda? ¿Qué me puede decir de eso?
Bueno, yo no me acuerdo muy bien las fechas. No me acuerdo muy bien de cuándo fue.
Esto se comenzó como el 30, el 31, los últimos del 30, los primeros del 31. El primero era voluntario y después como para el 32, el 33, comenzaron a forzar a muchas familias que deportar a muchas familias. ¿Usted no recuerda nada de eso?
Pues yo nunca supe que le reportaban el que quería irse, yo nomás yo supe.
¿Aquí estaba usted en ese tiempo? Sí. Aquí en San Diego. ¿Me puede dar una comparación del crimen que hay hoy con las condiciones que existían en los 30s o los 40s? ¿Cómo estaba el crimen en esos tiempos? ¿Cómo se portaba la plebe en otras palabras?
Bueno, en aquel tiempo no era tanto como ahora. Ahora está más, un poquito más peor que antes, o más peor. Antes no había robo, no había nada. Si dejaba la puerta abierta a su casa, nunca le llevaba nada. Y ahora no puede dejar nada, hasta las puertas le pueden abrir. Para agarrarle un poquito que tiene uno. A mí me abrieron el otro día una puerta, pero no supe quién. Un cuchillo, ¿no? Y buscaban puro dinero, porque no hallaron más de 5 rollos de pene que tenía. Y, no sé quién sería, pero no sé. Buscaban dinero, pero no tenía dinero, pues lo único que tenía eran 5 rollos de pene que había dejado ahí. Cuando estábamos en La Vega.
¿Hasta qué grado usted está envolviado en la política?
Yo no.
Nunca
he sido político.
¿No vota usted? ¿Nunca ha votado?
No.
¿Es ciudadano?
No. Quise ser, pero no pasé. Porque no speak English. No, mi señora sí quería, pero ella no pasó por un, no pudo escribir algo. Ella hizo su, quería ser su ciudadana ella.
¿Sus hijos?
Son nacidos aquí todos. Ahí está una, mira, que está aquí. Es mi hija. Esa es la mayor.
Esto termina las preguntas que le quería preguntar a usted. Pero si tiene usted algo que quiere incluir, que es algo que usted recuerda.
Yo no tengo ninguna otra cosa. Ahorita no creo que ponerle más.
Entonces,
yo creo que es bastante, querido.
Entonces, muchas gracias, señor Márquez, y tú muy agradecido.
My name is Jesse Soriano. I am an undergraduate student at San Diego State University, and I created the following tape for Dr. Richard Griswold de Castillo's Chicano History class in cooperation with Dr. Steve Colston of the San Diego Research Center on April 25th, 1978. The person interviewed is Mrs. Graciela Perez of San Diego, California. The subject of our discussion was Mrs. Perez's past history in San Diego.
¿Me puede decir su nombre, fecha de nacimiento y dónde nació?
Mi nombre es Graciela Pérez y nací el 7 de junio de 1920 en Gómez Palacio, Durango, México.
¿Me puede hablar de su experiencia en México antes de emigrar para los Estados Unidos?
Pues vivir bien. Mis padres vivían en clase media, pero ya con hijos uno le aspira por venir para que mejoren los hijos, y esa fue mi intención, venirme. Les di escuela a mis hijos hasta high school en México, y luego me los traje para acá.
¿Qué era la fecha cuando emigraron para los Estados Unidos?
¿Mis hijos? Yo emigré sola primero, en el 15 de junio de 1954.
¿Y qué modo de transportación usó para cruzar para este lado?
Pues yo pasé por el Paso, Texas. Por el Paso, Texas, el 15 de junio de 1954. Ahí estuve viviendo en Texas como año y medio, 2 años, y de ahí me vine para San Diego. Me gustó el estado de California, vine de visita y me gustó, y aquí ya me quedé. Después mi esposo vino para acá, cuando él ya había estado antes en Estados Unidos, cuando había contratados y todo eso, que venía y se estaba aquí, pero él trabajaba para la compañía Singer en México, la capital.
¿Dónde vivían cuando de principio llegaron aquí a San Diego?
De principio que venimos, vivimos aquí en la 532 Crosby Street. Y de aquí no he salido. Hoy vivo en la 1984 Irving, calle 1984 Irving Avenue.
Cuando llegaron aquí, ¿en qué clase de empleo se hallaba su familia y usted?
Pues nomás yo. Me vine aventada a trabajar en restaurantes, en lavanderías, en cleaner, en restaurante, en todo. Le hice de todo. El último trabajo que tuve fue en la California, en el Kelly French, el French Kelly, algo así de Londres, y ya paré, porque estoy enferma.
¿Qué me puede decir de su familia? Por ejemplo, la educación que tuvo su familia aquí en los Estados Unidos. ¿Dónde fueron a la escuela? ¿Hasta qué grado llegaron?
Pues mis hijos fueron a la escuela, como le dije, toda la primaria la terminaron, high school, ¿cómo le llaman aquí?
Secundaria.
Secundaria en México. Y vinieron de 15, 16 años, estuvieron aquí, fueron a... Uno de ellos fue a la high school de aquí de San Diego, pero no graduó porque se casó luego. Le faltaron 3 meses para graduarse y ya no quiso seguir. Me prometió que se iba, en ese entonces teníamos que firmar porque él era menor de edad y nos vimos en la necesidad de firmar porque venía una criatura de por medio y eso fue por lo que se casó el joven.
¿Cuántos miembros hay en su familia?
En mi familia tengo 2 hijos con 7 nietos, 3 hijos con 7 nietos.
Cuando usted llegó aquí a los Estados, a San Diego, ¿cómo se sentía que se trataba el americano con el mexicano?
Feliz, porque yo trabajé con gente americana que con gente mexicana. A mí me trataron bien.
¿Nunca sintió que había fracciones?
Discriminación, no.
¿Nunca oyó nada de otras personas que
hablan de México y que dicen cosas de México? Eso es común, hasta la fecha hablan y cosas peores, pero efectivamente, pues yo creo que en todas partes es lo mismo, ¿verdad? Que se vivía más cómodamente antes, más tranquila, más sin temor, no había tanta criminación, no había tanta cosa, eso sí se veía, porque como le digo, dejaba uno su casa abierta, yo me iba a trabajar, dejaba a mis hijos y me iba tranquila a trabajar, salía de un restaurante en la mañana y me metía a otro en la tarde. Así es que, tranquilidad, ahora es cuando se ven cosas, ¿verdad? Que está uno espantado, pero pues ni modo, los tiempos cambian.
¿Usted nunca ha estado envuelta en la política?
No, la ignoro porque ignoro el idioma. Voy a la escuela, pero muy burra, nunca me ha entrado el inglés. Si no hubiera dejado de trabajar con los americanos, posiblemente el lírico lo hablara, pero pues me vine y me metí a la California pura chicanada y se me acabó la peseta de inglés.
¿Nunca votó? ¿Usted es ciudadana?
No, estoy tratando de hacerme ciudadana.
Con estas preguntas termino la entrevista, que las preguntas que le quiero preguntar. Si tiene usted algo que quiere incluir, lo puede incluir ahorita.
No, pues nomás que vivo a gusto en Estados Unidos y no me quejo, la prueba está que me voy a hacer ciudadana, tanto yo como mi esposo. Muchas gracias.
Muchas gracias, señora Pérez, por su cooperación.
My name is Jesse Soriano. I'm an undergraduate student at San Diego State University, and I created the following tape for Dr. Richard Griswold de Castillo's Chicano History class in cooperation with Steve Colson and the San Diego Research Center on April 25th, 1978. The person interviewed is Luis Alvarez of San Diego, California. The subject of our discussion was Mr. Alvarez, past history in San Diego.
Can you tell me your name, date of birth, and where you were born?
My name is Louis Alvarez. I was born in Los Angeles, January the 5th, 1912.
Can you, were your parents born in Mexico?
My father was born in Mexico, and my mother was born in New Mexico.
Do you know any? Do you know of their experience in Mexico? What kind of life they led? What kind of work they were employed in?
My father was a painter all of his life. His father was an impresario from the Mexican bullring back in the early, or rather in the late 1800s.
What was the reason your parents immigrated to the United States?
My father immigrated to the United States when he was around 13 years of age. It's to adventure more than anything else. He came to the United States.
Did he ever tell you what kind of transportation he used to come over here?
In them days, he probably, more or less, I think he walked across the border in them days, because there wasn't much transportation in them days, and the towns were real small. I think, if I recall, he came through El Paso, Texas.
Did he ever tell you why he came? Why he came to California? Or,
well, he'd heard about the California Gold Rush, and he came out to California, and he did some mining at a time there, just an adventure more or less. And he went to Reno, Nevada, and Las Vegas, Nevada, in them days, that in the early 1900s.
When did he first come to San Diego or to L.A.?
He lived in El Paso, Texas for about 4 years, and then went to New Mexico for about 10 years. Then he came to California in about 1918, and he was a house painter, and he worked at that trade most of his life in California.
Do you recall when you first came to San Diego?
He came down in 1925, his first visit to San Diego, and then in 1928 he moved into San Diego, and our family living in Santa Barbara at that time, we came in June 28, 1928 to San Diego, and we've been here ever since, all of our family.
What part of town did you live in?
We always lived in the Logan Heights district, which is known as Logan Heights.
When you arrived here in San Diego, what kind of job did you and your family work in?
My father continued to work in the painting business, and my mother worked for about 5 or 8 years at the cannery, and I became a shoemaker, and I worked at the shoe repairing for about 4 years. Later on, I went into the gasoline service station, and I ran a couple of service stations in San Diego for about 3 years. Then I went to Convair, and later on I became a Mexican food merchant, restaurant business, making Mexican food products.
What can you tell me about your family, your family's education, and yourself? What schools they went to, what grades to what grades they accomplished?
Myself, I went as far as the ninth grade, completed junior high, and I've had correspondence courses in different trade schools, and I've had some Navy schooling when I was in the Navy during the World War II, and I have done quite a bit of reading, and I acquired a fairly good educational background through correspondence schools and things of that sort. Had taken up several trades, tinsmith and shoemaking and mechanical drawing and machinist made. I have diplomas for all of these different trades that I've worked in at different times. My children, they went to Their primary school was at Guadalupe Catholic School in San Diego, and they went to about 5 years of school, two boys and one girl. And then they went to junior high school, Logan High School, and one of them finished at Stanford University, his education at Stanford University, and the other one went as far as 2 years of university.
How was the racial situation in the schools you went to as a child in elementary school? Was it racially segregated, or was it more or less equally distributed?
In the beginning, when I was going to school, which was in about 1919, the schools were segregated at that time. There was, in fact, in the school I went to, it was kind of a rare thing to see a colored person in school at that time. I went to Catholic school, and you hardly ever saw any colored people in that school. They were mostly all white or Spanish surname people at the Catholic school. When I went from there, I went to public school, and public school there was kind of more or less segregated on a voluntary method. The people seemed to stay into with their own races of their own will, and of course, like in them days, they used to kind of look down on the Italians. They were known as Dagos, and the Mexican people were known as Greasers, and the colored were known as niggers. So in them days, why there was a little bit of class conditions in them days.
Do you recall? What do you recall about the during the Depression, during the Prohibition?
During the Prohibition, there was many people that used to drink, and they had to buy liquor that was made with the equipment that wasn't sterilized, and many people got poisoned. Some people got blind from it. Some people died from drinking liquor that was not made in the right way. And there was quite a bit of bootlegging, what was known in them days, bootlegging. And a lot of people made their own brews at home, fixed up malts, and a lot of people suggest what to make it with. Some people get some brew and start making with malt, with rice, with potatoes in it, add everything that someone suggested. They made up a pretty good concoction. It made you feel pretty good, but it wasn't, never got too much out of hand. It was pretty well controlled.
Was there any liquor brought in from Mexico?
In the early 30s, yes, every once in a while people would go down, and they weren't really too strict on it, because people would sometimes come across, and they was kind of aware that they was bringing maybe a little liquor or something like that. But things were the cities were so small and so united that people didn't really pay too much attention to it when they was caught with a little half a pint or something like that of liquor.
In what conditions did you find yourself and your family during the Depression?
During the Depression, things were pretty hard. The majority of people had to depend on a lot of relief and things of that sort. There was what we call the food lines. There was government took over fruit and vegetables and different things like that, and the people would go out and stand in line and wait to be given bags full of fruit and vegetables. And then the bakeries would give the day-old bread, and it was redistributed among the poor people in the town. There's many people that stood in line for food, and many people during that time went broke with little savings they had when the government the banks kind of went under at that time. That was in the about 28-30 period.
Were you aware of the deportation campaign by this government to deport Mexicans that were supposedly here illegally, and the ones that were without, the ones that were unemployed or on relief?
To my knowledge, no. The only thing I do know is that many people were asked both by the Mexican government and told by the American government that they can return to Mexico.
Second World War. Three of us brothers served in the, two of us in the Navy, and one in the Army. And during that time, there were many Mexican nationals were given the privilege of serving in the services, and they were given citizenship in return. At that time also, I noticed that there was there seemed to be a change in the attitude between the rest of the citizenry to the Mexican people. They began to come into their own, in other words, and they were treated more equal, being that they had been comrades in arms during the war. They were treated with much more respect. They began to be able to fill in and take in their proper places among the community.
During this time, were Mexicans recruited to come and work in the factories and other places, shipyards and stuff, during this time?
During this time, during the war, and for a short period afterward, many people were brought into work in different fields of labor in the United States. For example, they had what we call as a braceros, which did mostly agricultural work. But still, there were some people that came and worked in the aircraft factories and different munition plants and things of that sort. And there was a great demand for labor, and in fact there wasn't enough labor at the time, and everything was pretty prosperous. There was plenty of money, but little things to buy, as there was no manufacturing at that time of refrigeration, autos and things of that sort. So there was quite a bit of money floating around at that time. Things looked very prosperous for a few years during the World War II.
In comparison with the high crime rate of today that we're all aware of, how was the crime, the rate of crime back in the 30s or the 40s, in your point of view?
Back in the 30s and during the 40s, there wasn't as much crime as there is now. There was more respect between people, especially the younger people towards their seniors, and it has been deteriorating up to the period of our times now, and we find that there's little respect between young people and older people, and in school, children for the teachers and things of that sort, which contributes a lot to the crime, because there's not the respect for property or people that we used to have. In the olden days, or what we call the olden days, in the 30s and 40s, people were very united, very friendly, and you could leave your home without having to bolt it down and lock it down and feel pretty safe that no one would bother you. Nowadays, it's things have gotten out of control, that where there's a lot of crime that it shouldn't be, because there's really no reason for destroying property and things like breaking windows and things like that, but things that really don't bother anybody, but people just go ahead and break them. Then again, a lot of people are afraid to report or say anything about it for fear to get involved, because they don't want to get involved in anything. They can see something, they just turn away and ignore it, as if just say like it's not there.
Have you been involved with any political parties?
No, I haven't been involved in any direct, that is to say, but I've been voting ever since I've been 21 years of age, and I have voted in every election, and I think that poor people should take their rights and vote. A lot of people are always complaining about things and how things are not right, but still, when it comes to their time to vote, where they can say something about what goes on, why they don't vote, and then afterward they say, well, the other party won. But we should always remember that one vote nullifies another, and if you don't vote, why, you have two votes against one.
Do you recall what was the biggest, the most important issue that you remember back, you know, that you thought was the one issue that you were, that brought your attention, that greatly brought your attention to it, that you thought was of great importance?
You mean politically?
Yes.
Like, for an example, like, well, we've always been telling our children that we should always be honest, respect people, and obey the laws and everything. And I think that part of the, when we begin having through the newspapers and TV and radio, letting us know that a lot of our heads of government themselves were doing things that were illegal, that give the you couldn't stand and say, well, don't do anything wrong, because the children would say, well, from the president on down are doing things that are not right. So they follow example, and they figure that if they can do it, that why shouldn't they do it? And that has set a bad example in my concept for all of the children of our age. They always say, well, if so-and-so can do it, well, why can't I? And that's a bad attitude to take. A bad example we've had by a lot of our representatives in our government.
Well, this completes the set of questions that I wanted to ask you, Mr. Mr. Alvarez. And is there any other points of interest that you would like to include?
The only thing I could say is that a lot of people should unite together and help each other and have a lot more cooperation between everybody. For an example, I'm now working with the senior citizens, and I'm in the senior citizen group, and I think that a lot should be done for them, because we've gone through a lot in our time, and I think that we have, they don't owe it to us, but we have a right because of our efforts, which have made this country what it is today, one of the strongest countries in the world, and industrially and otherwise. So that I think that they shouldn't forget the senior citizens. They should be taken care of.
Thank you, Mr. Alvarez. My name is Jesse Soriano. I am an undergraduate student at San Diego State University, and I created the following tape for Dr. Richard Griswold at Castillo's Chicano History class in cooperation with Dr. Stephen Colston of the San Diego Research Center on April 25th, 1978. The person being interviewed is Mr. Santiago Flores of San Diego, California. The subject of our discussion was Mr. Flores' past history in San Diego. Can you tell me your name, date of birth, and where you were born?
Yeah, my name is Santiago Flores. I was born in Mexico, Chihuahua State, Chihuahua. Chihuahua, the capital of Chihuahua, I was born there. July 25th, 1902.
Can you tell me about your experience in Mexico before immigrating to the United States?
Well, I was too young yet, and it was during the revolution, the Villa and Madero's revolution. So my only adventure I got there is try to help my father earn money so he can take care of us, because there was no work, nothing but revolution, and we had a hell of a time those days. So that's all I can say about my young days doing in Mexico.
So during this time, there was very little work, and it was very much turmoil.
No, there was for at least, I remember, 3-4 years. My father was a miner all his life before the revolution. And naturally, even with the revolution, everything was paralyzed, trains and transportations and mines had to close. And in fact, everything was going to hell. And we, the poor people, were the ones to suffer, because the rich guys, they had a chance to go to Europe, come to the United States, bring their money to live happily over here. But us poor, we had a hell of a time over there. And as I tell you, we were hungry many times during my young days. and this and this about all I can tell you about the times, up till the time.
When did you first immigrate to the United States, you and your family?
We immigrated to the United States in July 15, 1915. And we crossed through El Paso. My father and mother and 14 children, boys and girls. And
when did you first come to San Diego?
Well, San Diego, I came over here about 1964, but I live in Los Angeles 47 years straight through, and then I moved over here to myself alone. My family is still living in Los Angeles. Many relatives and sons and daughters that I have over there yet. But me, myself, I came 1964, and I've been living over here ever since. I visit my kids often, and but I've been here since 1964.
What kind of work did you find when you first came to the United States initially?
Well, when I came to the United States, there was the time of the First World War, and I was going in my 14th year of life. And they need all the help they can, workers to help with everything. My father was a miner. My brother was working in a mine inside, underneath, and my father. And then they need some more help up outside on the top of the mine. And so they asked the fathers, they had the children about my age, if we could go help break the ore apart, put apart the ore from the rock, you know. And that's what I did during the war. Not too many months. Maybe I did it, say, 8, 10 months of that time. But I, ever since I put my part in the First War and the Second War, I'll tell you later when this young man asked me a question.
What can you tell me about your family as far as education, you and yourself? Did you go to school, or did your family, where did they go to school at?
Well, my mother, she never did go to school in Mexico. During her young days, according to what I was told from them, there were nobody was forced to send the kids to school. Besides, there were hardly no schools. The ones that went to school are the ones that pay their teachers, and they had their own teachers. They paid themselves for the kids, those had money. But those that didn't have no money, they had to go public schools, which there were hardly none. And so my mother never learned. In fact, she died at 84 years old. She still couldn't tell a $5 bill from a dollar bill, which is true, you know. And she died in Los Angeles, and she couldn't even tell the time, because she was entirely without any education. My father had a fairly good education, but I don't think he went to school. According to our grades here, maybe he went to school to fourth, fifth grade, I guess, and he started work very young. So he knew how to read and write, but not like a school kid. He has his diploma nowadays. So that's all the education my father and my mother had.
How do you feel you were treated as being a Mexican? How did you feel you were treated by the local population, the American people
in the United States? Well, as we later on, as after we lived in Arizona during my young days, when the First War started, when the war ended, then we started to move from the mines, because they all closed too on after the war, and there was no work for us and my father, so we moved to Phoenix, Arizona, then to Prescott, Arizona, and from there on to L.A. But according to other treaties, I didn't. In those days, I was so young that I didn't pay no attention one way or the other. See, until later on, I shall tell you later.
What was your experience during the Prohibition, when it was not allowed to possess liquor or steal liquor?
Well, during the Prohibition, I was already an older kid, more and more older than I was in Arizona. the provision. I started to know about it here in California, in LA. And of course, I was already 19, I guess. And I went through all the probation there. And I, when I learned from seeing my father, my brothers, obtaining liquor from the speakeasies, which were many. Some of them were in their own, their houses. The people, children leave there, you know, families. They make liquor to sell it to people they want to buy it. They call them speakeasies. They were big places. They were run really like business, like a legal business. But you had to go in there you had to have introduction cards, or by at least by name or sounds that you had to make in the doors. And they open the door, or a little window, and then they know you, or you give the signal, and let you in. And which I did do that in the later time of the provision. And after I got married, my wife and I, rented a place that had a very big cellar. So I tell you, that's the truth. I started to make my own beer, and even my little kid would help me put the sugar with a little spoon in the bottles. He was just about 3 or 4 years old, and he used to be for fun. He'd let him put the sugar in the bottles, which he took sugar and melt. I always had enough beer to drink. But then in the later years, Italian friends of mine, they showed me how to make wine. So I started making wine, as I had a big cellar. And really, I used to make 175 gallons of wine a year. One ton, Zinfandel grape, that was for red wine. And then Muscatel wine, I made 25 gallons, 25, a quarter of a ton of Muscatel, which then was a white wine that they call a white port nowadays. And I did that for years until the provision days were over.
What about, what kind of position did you and your family find yourselves during the Depression, the Great Depression in the 30s?
Well, during the Depression, I was already married, and I was working for Armor and Company, Packing House. I worked 21 years for Armor and Company there in L.A. And during the Depression, I got a very, very clear idea how it was, because I passed it there in L.A. I was very lucky. I met my wife in the Armor and Company. She was working there. We got married. And she was an older worker there in the plant, and I was an older worker in the plant. I had a wonderful time during the Depression. But my families, my brothers, sisters, and aunts, and most of my family, my kins and them, all, they were suffering a lot. No work, no nothing. In fact, I had a sister that I had to take a basket of groceries every week, because we had the money. I was making $21 a week. My wife was making 17, but there was enough. Those days there was enough to buy a lot of things. So I had to help my brothers, my sisters, my mother, especially my mother and father. But I was in a position that I didn't feel the depression. In fact, I even had one lady can take care of my kid at home, because she needed work, and I used to pay her $3 a week, $3 a week, and board and room for her little kid. She had a kid. So, but I knew the depression was terrible, because I had friends, I had people that were really starving to death, until Roosevelt took over from Hoover, as you all know, and then things started to get better and better and better. In fact, the WPA that he had there then for the kids to work, for the people to work, that was a pretty good program that gave life to the whole country. And in fact, they started to buy even cars with the WPA, which is true. Just before Hoover helped them, before Roosevelt helped them, they had nothing, not even something to eat, no money to for transportation, no nothing. As soon as they started to get their money, their checks every month from the WPA, and then they started to have enough to eat, and even buy their own transportation, old cars, like we still buy old cars ourselves, you know. And but I know that the depression was terrible during the Hoover days, until Roosevelt came in. So we all of us poor people still remember Roosevelt as one of our heroes.
Do you feel there was a job discrimination against Mexicano during the Depression by the American, the Anglos?
Well, the discrimination didn't stop until after the Second War. The day started to bring what they call it, a los trabajadores que traían braceros. They started to bring the braceros over here. Then, as they need help, a lot of help from everybody, they would help. We always trying to do the best to save our country. And but the discrimination was from before that. I know myself in Prescott, Arizona, where we moved from the mining camps where my father was working, Prescott, Arizona. The theater there, we Mexicans had to go on the balcony. No Mexican laws in the main floor. That's when I started to feel the discrimination. Also, I was too young yet. But when I moved to L.A., when we moved to L.A., that's when I felt the discrimination. They wouldn't let us go into Bimini, a swimming pool in Venice. No Mexican would be allowed in Venice in that Bimini swimming pool. Theaters. They won't let her, and certain theaters they won't let her. I know because it happened to me and my girl. When I remember several times I tried to get in for, you know, pay my ticket and go in, and no upstairs and no downstairs for us. That's true, honest to God, the truth. But I wasn't embarrassed. I was so young, I didn't realize that it was discrimination. But I noticed it until the war was the Second War started, because one of my brother-in-laws in Pasadena, there was a public swimming pool too, and we were in a picnic one Saturday, and my little brother-in-law asked us if we let him go to swim, him and other kids. They came back mad. They said that they didn't let him in because they were Mexicans. But as I'm going to tell you, discrimination. When the war started, then they took my brother to a soldier thing. My brother-in-law, three brother-in-laws. In fact, they went over there. One died. One of them died. The one that was rejected from going into the pool in Pasadena, he went to war and he died in one of those. I guess you all remember one ship that the Japanese took from us, and then they loaded with prisoners. And then they put the American, they put the Japanese flag, and the Americans bombed that ship, and that's where my brother-in-law died, which is the one that they rejected there in Pasadena. And as I know, I know there was a lot of discrimination then. Even at work, we wouldn't sit down with American fellows at lunchtime. We all make our own. Take our own place someplace else, and they and the others and some other place, you know, like at lunchtime nowadays. Nowadays, we Mexican colored people and everybody, we get together and go to the same restaurant, sit down in the same place wherever we want to, bunches of us, and eat, I know. And that's what I say about the discrimination. After the war was over, so many Mexicans went over there, Indians, colored people, everything. When they came back, they fought for their rights. Which I know my brother-in-law, another brother-in-law from my sister's husband, he was one that fought going to Texas, after he came from the army. They still didn't want no Mexican restaurants. But as they came back from the war, and they know that they fought for the country, and for this country to be saved, and they fought, they had the right to be treated as Americans, you know, as they deserve it. No more discrimination. So the discrimination started to disappear since the Second War was over. And that I know for sure.
Are you familiar with the deportation, the repatriation program that was initiated here by this government right around the right around the Depression as a means of deporting Mexicans out of, and stabilizing the economy, which they, in other words, they were blaming the Mexicans for the problems of the economy at that time. Were you familiar? Were any of you?
Yes, I'm very familiar with that because my sister and her husband and three or four kids, I don't remember how many, they were not forced. I'm not saying they forced them to be deported, not deported, just, well, yes, sent to Mexico. You see. But it was by their own consent. I'm not saying that my brother, my brother-in-law and my sister went over there forced. No, but I was in L.A. and my brother, when we went to say goodbye to my sister, my brother in the train, passenger car train, beautiful, just like we have now, they allowed them and they gave them $50 a family, $50 cash, and they took all their furniture, everything, the whole house full of furniture, up to El Paso. And so they even had music. They had bands that playing, which is true, you know. They had bands there saying goodbye and playing La Golondrina, which is a song they always say for the goodbye. And I was there, and many trains full of Mexicans went, families went that way. But as far as knowing that they were forced, no, I don't remember. Maybe it was. I can tell you, but I can't remember. But I know that thousands and thousands, a lot of friends of mine, they went to Mexico that way. And some of them, they never came back because that was their promise that if they go, they would never have to come back. Which my brother and my sister, they died over there in Juarez, Mexico, and they had a hell of a time all those years. I know because in my vacations, I used to go there in vacations and see how poorly they were living, but it was their fault because they didn't force them to get out of here. That's for sure that I know. And as far as other things, well, there was all there was to it. They used to talk to them, as I know, the families. They go and interrogate them and think that they want to stay there, here suffering hunger, like everybody, Americans, Mexicans, they were, we all, some of them, I didn't suffer, I was working, my wife and I. But millions and millions of people during the crash, you know, the bank crash, you know, the depression, there was rich people, millionaires that went poor and they even committed suicide, as we know if we read the history. They jumped the buildings in New York and all those places, all those that one day to the next they had no more money. The banks crashed and everything. That I know for sure because I was then young and my mind was bright, not like I have it now. I forget a lot of things now. If 10 years from now you ask me for what I went through these 10 years, maybe I won't have nothing to tell you because I'd be forgotten everything because I'm too old now. But that's the way of the depression. And it lasted very, very long, until Roosevelt took over, thanks to Roosevelt.
Were you ever questioned by authorities as did you ever have to prove your citizenship or your legality of being here in the United States to authorities during this campaign to repatriate Mexicans?
To repatriate Mexicans?
Did authorities ever come to you asking you for your papers?
No, not that I remember. Not my father, mother, not me. No, nobody that ever asked us. Because they took it for granted we were here. Because during those days, crossing to the United States, it was easy. Everybody was here was supposed to be legal. Very few had to cross illegal like they do nowadays. See, all you had to do is pay 2 cents in the crossing over in El Paso. And if you put your name in the great big book they had there, in the immigration place, all the father or mother, when we move, all he had to do is write my name, my brother's and sister's name, his father, his name, and my mother's, and the date, and that's it. That makes us legal to live here in the United States. So I don't ever remember ever being stopped in any place, asking my nationality or if I'm here legal or illegal. And now that I'm an American citizen, well, much less reason they have to ask me. When I crossed the line, only once did one girl there, the immigration officer there, she asked me for my credentials. And I said, well, I don't have the credentials, but I can swear to you and that I am an American citizen. He said, well, but we have to have it. I says, look, ask me some questions, and I'll answer them to you. Any questions you want to be about the history of the United States, me, everything, and where I live, how long I've been living here. He said, okay, okay, I believe you. I believe because I just talk frankly, you know that. Because as I see, you know, when we cross, black, white, yellow, and red Indians, they pass there. When we give our word that we are American citizens, they're supposed to take it, which they do. Very seldom do they stop some suspect person. They have a right to stop somebody sometimes. But to me, that's only once that happened to me, and that never did happen. All I have to say is American citizens, that's all, which I am. And I haven't had no difficulties with any of the immigration officers.